please keep your Bibles open, because I'll be asking you to look with me quite a few times as we try and understand this text and what God's saying to us. But I'm going to start with a quote that I listened to in an audiobook while I was driving in the car. It's from the book called Gospel Comes with a House Key by an author called Rosaria Butterfield. And she says this, our cold, it's a bit harsh, but listen and see what you think. Our cold and hard hearts, our failure to love strangers, our selfishness with our money, our time in our home, and our privileged backs turned towards widows, orphans, prisoners, refugees, mean we are guilty in the face of God of withholding love in the face of Christian witness. And even more serious is our failure to read our Bibles well enough to see that the creation ordinance and the moral law, first found in the Old Testament, are as binding to Christians as any red letter. Our own conduct condemns us, condemns our witness in this world. A red letter there, she's just referring to some Bibles have Jesus' words in red letters. And what I'm particularly interested in is it a fair quote? Is she fair in saying that we should know God's law in the Old Testament? Is it fair that we don't know that, and should we know it better? Is it relevant, and is it important? And is our witness damaged by our ignorance of that law? And I hope that as we look through Exodus, we might have a better answer to that. So we're going to look at chapter 19, and then we're going to look a bit at the function and meaning of the law, and I'll finish with two examples of just, we don't have time to look at all the laws, there's a lot there, but just two examples of what it could look like to take a law and to think about it, and what God is saying, what it reveals about God, and what it's functioning for. So look with me at chapter 19, verse 1. Let's see what Moses does. They arrive at Sinai, and you see that Moses very quickly is going up the mountain. The narrative has been moving in this direction for a while, the chapters leading up to here. And Moses has at last brought the people to the place where he's before met with Yahweh, and he goes straight up the mountain to engage with Yahweh. And Moses begins immediately. The story really dives straight into it. You see, look at verse 3. Already by verse 3, Moses is up the mountain and talking with Yahweh. This is going straight in. And that sort of should be a cue to us that this something exciting is about to happen. The narrative is really sort of picking up. It doesn't really feel like it to us, but it's intending to do that. It's picking up. Moses is talking to God. Now let's observe. Now look with me in verse 4 and see what Yahweh says. What he does is he's reminding Israel who he is, and he's using the story of the past events by talking about how he's brought them out from the Egyptians to reveal to them who he is. He is the one who saves us. Because if you think about it, we all have an idea of who God is, but who is God? Does the person next to you think God is who you think God is? Who is God? And so God is telling the Israelites, well, I am God, and I'm the one who brought you out from the Egyptians. I'm the one who saved you. And it's a helpful way for us to remember who God is and to identify him so we know how to relate with him. He's not just God. He's the God who brought his people out of, at that time, the strongest nation. And then, the God who calls the whole earth mine explains that this grumbling, lost baby of a nation will be his treasured possession. They will be his kingdom of priests even. Look with me at verse 5. Now, if you will carefully listen to me and keep my covenant, you will be my possession out of all the peoples, although the whole earth is mine. And at first glance, it kind of seems like there is a conditional clause there, that if they do this, God will do that, that God's grace might be conditional. Yet what's actually going on here is Yahweh is giving the people an opportunity to draw near, an opportunity to respond to who he is. He's extending grace by extending this covenant to the people. And in these few verses, we see that this is the pattern for the whole text, establishing who is Yahweh, how does he want us to respond to who he is, and then what will we choose? To respond rightly to who he is or not to? Kind of like a child, we're engaging with them and we say, you can respond, you can listen to me, and this time we have a playing together that will go well, or you can choose not to listen to me and you're not going to enjoy the time very well. And he's giving the people a choice. And we see also in verse 5 there that the word covenant is first used. I'll just explain that briefly in case you don't understand that. It kind of means like a contract, a relational contract or a deal. We'll use it quite a lot as we go throughout this text. And it's the grace of God to these people. Remember that they've come out of Egypt to worship Yahweh. And rather than just having the people worship him, as all the people that he's given breath should do, he's offering them this covenant, this relationship, not just for them to worship. Because remember, that there's nothing on the whole earth over which he does not say, mine. And he offers these people a covenant in order for them to respond rightly to who he is and be in relationship with him, be near to him. The people of Israel respond quickly, and obviously kind of ignorantly. They say, yes, we want to do everything that Yahweh says. I don't think they probably quite understand who he is and what that means for them to say yes at this point. But Yahweh will work on their hearts, and we'll see what happens by the end. So the story goes on, and Yahweh wants to have a meeting with the people and tell them about the covenant he wants to make with them. This, again, is a great display of grace. He wants to meet with them and engage with them personally. He wants to tell them about his covenant. And if you look in verse 13, however, we'll see that Yahweh is, however, so set apart and so other. So it's not going to be just an ordinary meeting. So if they want to come near, they must follow his instructions. And they can't come near in any other way other than the instructions that he gives. If they do, they'll be put to death. Look at verse 13. It says that they are not even to be touched in the execution of the judgment. If they disobey his command to touch the mountain or don't come near, when they don't consecrate themselves, even when they're executed, they're not even to be touched. Those people are so have broken the law in such a bad way that even when they were killed, they weren't supposed to be touched. And this was to help the people understand the weight of what is about to happen. They must understand the holiness of Yahweh, because knowing him as holy seems to be here a life and death matter. Now, as we continue to follow these events, we see that they do come to understand how set apart Yahweh is. I'll read from 16 and 17. On the third day, when morning came, there was thunder and lightning, a thick cloud on the mountain, a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people of the camp shuddered. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was completely enveloped in smoke, because the Lord came down on it in fire. Its smoke went up like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain shook violently. At first, the people tremble at the sight of the mountain, shrouded in symbols of power and wonder, and then the mountain itself begins to tremble. And Moses would have been the only one who was slightly familiar with the feelings of terror and rumbling in his guts. And then in stupidity, or perhaps in faith, he opens his mouth and spoke to the one for whom the trumpet was drowning out all other sounds. It would have been terrifying knowing that someone could hear your whisper over the blast of the trumpets. And then in verse 20, Yahweh responds, calling Moses up Sinai. I think it would sort of have been like an invitation, someone inviting you to join them in the middle of an erupting volcano. Quite inviting. But to further communicate how holy Yahweh is, the author goes on and explains that even the priests, the chosen ones who are set apart, they must also take special precautions to set themselves apart. Look at me at verse 22. Yahweh's instructions here in 22 give us a better understanding of why the people had to consecrate themselves. If they were not setting themselves apart, as verse 22 says, to consecrate themselves, then they would have been set apart by Yahweh. Verse 22 says that at the end, the Lord will break out in anger against them. In a sense, they are still consecrated to Yahweh, even if it's the second option, being the Lord's anger breaking out. If you consider that being consecrated means to be dedicated, their life is devoted to Yahweh either by their following their instructions and being able to draw near, or in their moral impurity, being burnt out as they come near. Either way, they are dedicated to Yahweh, either in their following instructions or not. Sort of like the impurities of a gold nugget that are devoted to the furnace in order for the pure gold, or in Yahweh's case, the holiness, to be set apart from that which is impure. To be devoted to Yahweh is a fearful thing. If there's any imperfection that you would bring as you draw near, like metal in a furnace, it's melted away. Not as an act of malicious outbreak from Yahweh, but as the only natural reaction for something impure coming close to the holy. And that's why it's so important that they follow these instructions he gives, because he's providing for them the means for them to come close. There's no other way. And so Moses responds in verse 23. Moses responded to the Lord, "The people cannot come up Mount Sinai since you warned us. Put a boundary around the mountain and consecrate it." And I'll continue. "And the Lord replied to him, 'Go down and come back with Aaron. But the priests and the people must not break through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out in anger against them.' So Moses went down to the people and told them." And what I think is quite interesting, and what we learn about God here is his concern for the people. He's giving them a second and even a third warning. He wants them, well, he knows that like a curious little boy, they'll be drawn to what is so different, so other, and so untouchable about this mountain. And they'll just want to take one little peek, one little touch, and one peek, lifting it up, would leak the fury of a blazing furnace on the impurity of the curious eye. And he's warning, he's saying to Moses, go warn them again. Make sure they understand this. With this in mind, if we were to look back at verse 12, when he talks about them being burned up or consumed or put to death, it sort of makes sense. I'll read it, and we could read it even something like this even, starting from 12. "Put boundaries for the people all around the mountain and say, 'Be careful that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Anyone who touches the mountain must be dedicated to Yahweh.'" And they either choose by following the law, or they choose to come near and are consumed. Either way, they are consecrated to Yahweh. And so we've been sort of looking at this chapter, and we've been seeing the holiness of Yahweh in here, how set apart he is. But something else I would like to draw our attention to is, remember in 17, or if you look in 17, you'll see that this is a meeting. I'll read verse 17. "Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain." It seems like it would be an interesting meeting, as I mentioned earlier, meeting with the Holy One, joining someone in the middle of a volcano, or maybe like a meeting with the sun. It should be impossible, really, just like it would be impossible for us to meet the sun. But Yahweh is gracious and gives them these instructions as a means for them to come near. The people are not free to come near to Yahweh, however they see fit. He has established that he is good and that he's concerned with the people. He's delivered them and provided for them, but they may not come near without the grace that he has provided for them to come near to himself. I think surely the people would have understood that God is good. But the question is, will they allow the story that's unfolding here to shape their lives and their understanding of who he is? Or will they make their own understanding of who he is? When the mountain is gone and all that is left is the story and the things to come, the smoke is gone and the fire is gone, they'll be tempted to think that they can draw near to Yahweh however they want, that they can worship in whatever way they wish. But it's because of the severity of Yahweh's holiness that they and we should take note of this meeting that Yahweh has with his people. Remembering that to be devoted to Yahweh is a dangerous thing, that it's like meeting the sun, but should be impossible because of the differences. A meeting with the God of creation should be impossible, not because of physical differences, but because of the differences in almost every other way. But what is the most significant difference between us and God? What is it that makes God holy? What is it that makes God so other to us, so transcendent? And that's what's revealed to us as we turn to chapter 20. And in chapter 20, we are again reminded of who God is. Verse 2 says, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the place of slavery." Then what we have, later described in the Bible as the 10 words, the 10 commandments, which is the summary of all the law that will follow. And we don't have time to go through each of these laws, as I've mentioned. It is likely that these ten commandments are a summary of all the laws that will follow. So there's a whole bunch of laws that are going to follow from 20 to 24. And these 10 that we have here, however, are like a summary of everything that follows. And in each of these commandments and all the commandments that follow, what is amazing about them is that they're packed with the revelation of who God is and the revelation of who we are. And that's partly why we don't have time to go through them, because they're packed with the revelation of who God is and the revelation of who we are. So to go through each one, as you'll see when we go through two examples, takes quite some time to unpack who God is revealing himself to be in the commandment and what God is saying about us through the commandment. The words are a revelation of Yahweh. And the question is, do we know these words? Do we know these laws? If not, then in some sense we don't know our God. If we don't know our God, then how could we possibly worship him rightly? And my prayer is that we will see the beauty of these words, that we would learn why it is that the whole book of the Psalms is introduced with words like this: blessed is the person whose delight is in the law of Yahweh. Why is it that the songbook of the Bible is about the law? For us, that's just bizarre. But this section of law, from 20 to 23, is referred to in chapter 24, verse 7, as the book of the covenant. It's the instructions on the nature of the covenant, and we've talked about the covenant being this contract, this relational contract between two people. And it helps a little bit in understanding why it's worth singing about when you see it as the book of the covenant. It's the book of the relationship. Perhaps you could even say it's the marriage vows of the relationship Yahweh has with his people. Not that it's a marriage between Yahweh and his people, but in the same way a marriage has a contract, has a covenant, the covenant of marriage, Yahweh is making a covenant with his people. And just as you might frame your, I don't think we've done this, but some, you know, you might frame your vows and put them on the fridge or something, on the window. So also, these people were to understand that Yahweh's covenant, his book of the covenant, is like the vows he's making with these people. It's the nature of their relationship. And how is Yahweh revealed in these vows? We're going to see that he is holy, 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 morally transcendent. He reveals himself not as a philosophical thought or idea, but as the author of human life and the giver of human way of life, the one who is supremely moral. That's why it's preceded by chapter 19, which is all about how other God is, and how you cannot just come near him however you wish to come near him. There's a way in which you must come near him. And yet, I will go into two examples, but just before I do, I'll make one more point, that these laws are a revelation of who God is. They revealed him to the original reader, they reveal him to us. But I would just like to say that we have an even fuller revelation of who God is in Jesus, who is the exact likeness of God, as God come down as man, living among us. But I would just like to also point out that because of our ignorance of these laws, we miss much of the full picture of who Jesus is. Jesus is the perfect image of these Ten Commandments, if these Ten Commandments reveal who God is. And these Ten Commandments and the commandments that follow also then must describe who Jesus is. And so if we want to understand who Jesus is better, then we should give our attention to these laws that reveal who he is. The first example I want to look at is the second commandment in chapter 20, verse 4. And if you look there at that second commandment, you can see it's quite a bit longer than the first one, which just says to do not have any other gods besides me, and quite a bit shorter than much of the other ones. And one of the reasons is it's likely that this commandment was going to be tricky for the nation to follow. I'll read it. Do not make an idol for yourself, whether in the shape of anything in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the waters under the earth. Do not bow down and worship to them, and do not serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children of the father's iniquity to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing faithful love to 1,000 generations of those who love and keep my commands. You see, this is about using images or things to represent Yahweh. It's not so much about other gods, as the first commandment has already established that there shall be no other gods. But Yahweh is saying to make an image of him would be to commit idolatry. And so what do we learn about who Yahweh is from this commandment? What's communicated? What's communicated to us? If the whole creation, in the heavens above and the earth below, if the mightiest lion, the strongest bull, the brilliance of the sun, are not within all those things, there's nothing of which we can say, this is the likeness of Yahweh. Only the uncreated is left without any sort of comparison. Only the one who is above everything in existence has nothing left to be compared to. It would only be idolatry for God to have nothing made out of anything in this earth or in the shape of anything in the earth, because nothing in this earth fully captures who he is. If you chose a bull, it would fall short. If you chose the sun, it would fall short. To choose anything to make as the image of God would fall short of who he is, the idolatry. They must worship Yahweh for who he is and not who they envision him as. Not as other nations make images for their gods and represent their gods as bulls or suns, etc. Can you see how this law also reveals to us who Yahweh is, and can you see how it extends his grace? He wants us to be able to draw near. He wants us to be able to engage in relationship. And yet, if you draw near, you must draw near as he sees fit, not as you see fit. A.W. Tozer says this: what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And we will fight a constant battle to keep our minds, to keep in our minds Yahweh as he reveals himself, not as we would like him to be. Because God is anything other than who he has revealed himself to be is not a God at all, but a created being. If you create God as something else, he is not God anymore, but created. But the rubber really hits the road when we see the cost of being devoted to Yahweh, the one who says of our whole lives, mine. That is who Yahweh is. But we don't like it so much, so sometimes we change the story a little bit. We make an image of Yahweh as the one who provided us with a house, as the one who loves us so much and delights in us inviting our friends around so that we can care for them in our house. And then we bow down and worship the image that we have made of who Yahweh is, that is who he is, and we will worship him because of those reasons. Yes, he does provide, as we've seen in Exodus, and yes, he does give us friendships. He does give us coffee to taste and laughter to shake our bones and joy to fill our hearts like manna from heaven. But don't be fooled into thinking that is why he is worthy to be worshipped. Because in the next breath, he is also perfectly just to take your house, to take your job, take your car, a child or a spouse. But know this, that he will not sin against you in whatever he does. He is perfectly moral and cannot and will not and will never sin against you and has never sinned against you and will never sin against anyone. But we say, no, he has wronged me, he has asked too much of me, he has no right to say mine over that, he has no right to take that. But the question is, do we worship an image of Yahweh, or do we worship Yahweh as he really is? He is who he is, he is who he reveals himself to be, according to his grace. He is deliverer, redeemer, and provider, he is creator and covenant maker. And you cannot come near him outside his covenant. And you will not be able to keep his covenant outside of his grace. You cannot follow the rules of this law without his grace. And in this story, his grace to follow his law is this: that through the meditation of the law, he will change our hearts so that we will be able to keep his covenant. And that's why he had established festivals, and that's why he had the law written down, so that they could meditate on the law. And that's why the Psalms are about the law, because the singing and the meditation on the Psalms about the law were changing the hearts of the people. And that was God's grace to the people. Now let's look at a second example. Our first example was an example, I guess, of a law that Jesus would summarize as loving the Lord our God, and we'll look at another example, one that Jesus would summarize as loving your neighbor. If you go to 23, verse 12, it's a law about the Sabbath. It says, do your work for 6 days, but rest on the seventh day, so that your ox, your donkey, may rest, and the son of your female slave, as well as the resident alien, may be refreshed. So what does it say? What do we learn about who Yahweh is from this law? We can see he's compassionate, surely. This law is for those who don't have a voice. The animals and the slaves and the foreigners in the land. When these people became familiar with the creation story, this law would have also been a reminder to the people that Yahweh is creator. And our need to rest hangs on the fact that we are image bearers of this creator. We're made in his likeness, and so we rest like he rested on the seventh day. Their day of rest was intended to shape the whole community they lived in, for the animals and the slaves and the foreigners. They were all to be affected by this law. See, at the end of the verse, it says that they may be refreshed. Yahweh has revealed to his people that they are image bearers and they need rest. And this is surely his grace to them to reveal to them this. He has shown them the blueprint of the human life, that we are wired to image bear God, to be image bearers of God, and so we rest like God rests. And this is an extension of his grace. And how do we show his grace to the community? How do we love our neighbor? But similarly to the law that we just looked at, we don't really like to follow the law. We like to tell ourselves a different lie. We think that our greatest acts of service are applying our ideas of love and hospitality to others, like we have a self-authorized way to love people and draw near to them. We don't necessarily want to follow this law or the other laws that describe how to love our neighbor. We would rather come up with our own ideas of what would be a sacrificial act or what would be a kind act or generous act. But he's laid out for us the pattern, like Pierre said, the rhythm or a song of how we act. These are the patterns and the methods. This is the heart of the person who is the person of God. Yahweh says that we do not have a self-authorized way to love people. This is the covenant he's made with his people. He has authorized how we are to love our neighbors. We may feel as though we're doing good things, but if our love is not in the shape of this law, we are not worshipping Yahweh. We have again made an image of him that is different to who he is. So how is resting loving our neighbor? Firstly, we need to rest. We need to rest so that we're able to love our neighbors well. And this is true rest. I think not a rest of Saturdays filled with unfinished responsibilities or watching movies, but a rest of our hearts and a rest of our minds. Perhaps even a rest from the dictatorship of our phones, a rest from the slavery of Facebook maybe, a rest from TV shows that swallow our thoughts. This is the kind of rest that I find hard. I do hate the constant buzz in my head, but if I'm honest, perhaps I can't live without it. It's become like the ocean sounds that people put on for kids or listen to in their headphones when they go to sleep. And it feels weird not to have such busyness, drowning out other noises. But this kind of rest is real rest that allows us to remember the goodness and holiness of Yahweh and to have time and energy to love our neighbors. Our neighbor has been not been graciously shown the blueprint of the human life as we have. They've not been shown that they're image bearers of God, and they've not been shown that rest is required as we follow in the pattern of God. And so in our resting, we are able to invite them in and even encourage rest in their lives. Can you start to see why Jesus is able to say that the law is summed up in these two categories, to love God and to love your neighbor? Your neighbor being the image bearer of God. Because if we were to look through all the laws, we would see that they fall into these two categories, to love our neighbor and to love the Lord our God with all our heart. We've only just touched on two briefly. However, all the laws were read out to the people, and they were all filled with an increasing understanding of who God is and who we are as his people. See, in chapter 24, verse 6, it says, Moses took half the blood and set it in the basin, the other half of the blood he splattered on the altar. That's not the part where he read the book. It's verse 7, false. Then he took the covenant scroll and read it aloud to the people. This is like the vows that we were talking about. It's like this part of the interaction between Moses and between God and his people would have almost been like the exchanging of the vows and the saying of I do or I will and the putting on of the ring at a wedding ceremony. This part was the exciting part where the blood was used instead of rings. We probably don't want to pick up that in our weddings. But it was an exciting part. It was the consecration of the covenant. What is more, Yahweh has instructed the elders come up the mountain. He did that, sorry to jump back, but that instruction was given in verse 1. He says to go up. He says to Moses to go up to the Lord, you and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and the 70 of Israel elders, and bow down and worship at a distance. Now we come to verse 9 and we see that they're following that instruction in verse 9. So there was that bit of consecrating the covenant in the middle. Now we're up to verse 9, where Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 of Israel's elders. And again, Yahweh's holiness is on display here because we see that the elders look up and they see God. But all they see is beneath his feet something like pavement made from lapis lazuli, as clear as the sky itself. And they're blown away just by the pavement that God stands on. So again, this is in the context of God's holiness. But God did not harm them, but they saw him and they ate and drank. This is the height of God's grace in this story. He has brought them out of Egypt on the wings of the eagles, delivered them from Pharaoh's army, provided for them in the desert. And through the covenant he's made with his people, he's made a way for them not only to draw near, but to eat and drink with him. They've come so near with God that they eat and drink with him. The one who consumes mountains in balls of fire, smoke, and flames. The law has worked. The people are able to draw near to Yahweh. They followed it. They're now in relationship with Yahweh to the point of eating and drinking. And my encouragement for you is that as you read over the laws, you'd contemplate the grace of Yahweh in the law. Listen to the psalmists when he introduced the Psalms in Psalm 1 and says, blessed is the man who meditates in the law of Yahweh. In the same way that Yahweh intended for the book of the covenant to be read out, as we see in chapter 24, verse 7, where Moses read it out to the people. I'm also going to read out a portion of the law now. From 22, verse 21, to 23, verse 12. And I want to do this because it's a part of God's grace to his people. He knows that we will struggle to keep this covenant. And so he established festivals and routine times for the reading of the book. He gave the Psalms so that they would be sung about. Because the things we repeat to ourselves and to each other will change us. And Yahweh, the maker of us, knows how to change us. Because through the meditation of the law, Yahweh is changing the heart of his people, that they may be able to keep the covenant. It's through the meditation on his law that Yahweh is changing his people, so that they will be able to keep his covenant. This is what the people didn't realize at the beginning, when they eagerly accepted to take part of the covenant. They didn't realize that God was going to need to change them in order for them to keep them and draw near. Now, I've chosen this section because obviously we don't have time to read all of it, but it seems like this section might be easiest for us to sympathize with and take the least amount of work for us to understand. But when I finish, if you belong to the people of God and understand the grace of God, not only in this law but in Jesus, you are a people of God. And let us respond together the same way the people did in verse 7. When at the end of verse 7, they responded, we will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. So I'll read this, and then if we could all respond together, that we will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. Maybe we can do a practice one now, so that when I finish, your voice boxes will be warmed up. We will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. Okay, let's try that one more time. Ready? We will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. Excellent. Okay, so I'm going to read from 22, verse 21, 23, 12, and we're going to finish up. 22, verse 21. You must not exploit a resident alien or oppress him, since you are resident aliens in the land of Egypt. You must not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them, they will no doubt cry to me, and I will certainly hear their cry. My anger will burn, and I will kill you with the sword. Then your wives will be widows and your children fatherless. If you lend silver to my people, to the poor person among you, you must not be like a creditor to him. You must not charge him interest. If you take your neighbor's cloak or coattail, return it to him before sunset. For this is the only covering. For his only covering. It is his clothing for his body. What will he sleep in? And if he cries out to me, I will listen because I am gracious. You must not blaspheme God or curse the leader among your people. You must not hold back offerings from your harvest or your vats. Give me the firstborn of your sons. Do the same with your cattle and your flock. Let them stay with their mothers for 7 days, but on the eighth day you are to give them to me. Be my holy people. You must not eat the meat of the mauled animal found in the field. Throw it to the dogs. You must not spread a false report. Do not join the wicked in their malicious wickedness. Witness. You must not follow a crowd in wrongdoing. Do not testify in lawsuits and go along with a crowd to pervert justice. Do not show favoritism to a poor person in his lawsuit. If you come across your enemy's stray ox or donkey, you must return it to him. If you see a donkey or someone who hates you lying helpless under its load, then you want to refrain from helping it. You must help with it. You must not deny justice to a poor person among you in his lawsuit. Stay far away from a false accusation. Do not kill the innocent and the just, because I will not justify the guilty. You must not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and corrupts the words of the righteous. You must not oppress a resident alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be resident aliens and a resident alien because you are resident aliens in the land of Egypt. Sow your land for 6 years and gather its produce, but during the seventh year you are to let it rest and leave it uncultivated, so that the poor among you may eat from it and the wild animals may consume what they leave. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. Do your work for 6 days, but rest on the seventh day, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave as well as the resident alien may be refreshed. We will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. Let me finish up with just saying this. I think that Isaiah Butterfield is right, that we don't know Yahweh's law very well, and so we misunderstand who he is, and we worship him falsely. But in grace, he has shown us how to live as his people. And in grace, he has given us his very words. Think about this as the closing thought. Yahweh himself wrote down the law, as we see in chapter 24, verse 12. He wrote it and gave it to Moses. He said, I have written for their instruction. In his great grace, Yahweh not only gave us a way to come near to him, but he's given us the words that will change us as we constantly think on them. These words reveal who God is. These words are the revelation of God. These words are a picture of who he is. And so let us meditate on them. And I'll pray for that.